Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, August 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Islamic State group says one of its prominent leaders has been killed in Syria. Donald Trump faces a pivotal campaign moment on immigration. And this... Making music with a message. Also ahead, on African film industry pros are learning from Hollywood. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, the Islamic State group has announced that a prominent leader of theirs, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, who served as the extremist group's chief spokesman and also was linked to recruiting activities and attacks in Europe, has been killed in Aleppo province. International Edition's Michael Lippin talked to VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon about how unusual it is for the terror group to make such an announcement.
It's not all that surprising. Some of the most recent top Islamic State officials who have been killed in U.S. airstrikes or otherwise, the Islamic State through Amaq and other channels, Amaq being its news agency, has been trying of late to get out ahead, to announce the news first. Could be various reasons why, but it's been a trend that the U.S. has not been announcing it. Also, remember, the U.S. has been burned, as have other coalition members, in prematurely announcing the death of key Islamic State leaders, officials, commanders, some of whom have been killed, you know, numerous times before they're actually dead. So what happens when there's an airstrike or there's an action that could have resulted in the death of the leader? The U.S. has been very careful, both on the military side, the intelligence side, in vetting it, trying to make sure that the target they think they killed is actually dead. So the fact that it was announced by Amaq, not surprising at all. It's always possible, of course, that this is a misdirection play by Islamic State. No indication that that's the case, but there have been other times where key terror leaders have tried to fake their own death or convince the world of their own death so they could continue to fly under the radar. So it's still very early on. The fact that the announcement has not come yet from the U.S., not surprising. One other thing to consider, I spoke earlier with a U.S. official who confirmed to me that the U.S. had been tracking several what they call high-value individuals, HVIs, in Aleppo province in Syria. Was Adnani possibly one of the people on that list? It is possible, though we don't have confirmation of that.
Well, what is the significance of this IS militant Adnani to the organization?
He, in a way, is the voice of Islamic State. He was their top spokesman. But beyond that, he's even more important. And he was one of their senior leaders with the group really since the beginning, part of a core of leadership that had been detained by the U.S. in Iraq back when AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, first burst onto the scene. He knew a lot. He had a lot of connections. There was a lot of reporting that his role was much deeper than just being a spokesman, that he was part of also the external operations planning division, which, of course, would tie together both the spokesperson duties, but also the terror attack duties, specifically targeting the West. A lot of times he would be the one speaking on propaganda, talking about how a certain Western country would be targeted, which then followed up occasionally by an attack on that country.
What are your sources saying about, you know, the significance of the death of a militant like this to the group? Because the group has suffered territorial losses in Syria and Iraq.
One of the things that intelligence and military officials have long said about Islamic State is that it is very adept at adjusting to situations. It is flexible, it is adaptable, and it is resilient. So it finds a way to overcome these losses. One of the things that was noted early on was just simply the group's leadership structure, in which it seemed like no one individual ever knew too much and easily could be replaced by somebody lower down in the ranks. To some extent, that still exists. At the same time, however, military officials are very clear, and the commander of U.S. Central Command, who oversees U.S. forces in the region, helping lead the coalition effort against Islamic State, said earlier that the coalition is now really pushing into the heart of the caliphate, and that the group is facing pressures like it has not seen before. It does not have good choices it can make on one hand or the other. So there's a sense that Islamic State is on the retreat, that it is receding. But intelligence officials and the military equally adamant that a loss on the battlefield does not mean the defeat of the group, in that the group has always been most effective, most dangerous when it uses asymmetric tactics, terrorist tactics, and that it is still very much viable in that sense.
All right. That was VOA national security correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin. Meanwhile, during Secretary of State John Kerry's visit to India, the United States and that nation announced Tuesday that they are strengthening cooperation on fighting terrorism.
We agreed to expand the exchange of terrorist screening information, to deepen cooperation in designating terrorist groups at the United Nations, and to expedite mutual requests for legal assistance. More broadly, we reiterated our unwavering commitment to the protection of our citizens and to defeating the terrorist mantra of bigotry and of hate.
Meanwhile, the two democracies will intensify intelligence sharing and also agreed on a joint cyber framework to reduce cybercrime. Overall, ministers and officials of India and the United States are touting significantly expanded strategic and economic relationship, with which Secretary of State Kerry said couldn't come at a more important moment. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The UN Security Council weighs accountability for chemical weapons attacks in Syria. Italy holds a mass funeral for its earthquake victims. Democrats want the FBI to probe allegations of Russian efforts to tilt the U.S. vote. President Obama cuts short sentences of 111 federal inmates. And U.S. swimmer Ryan Lochte stays quiet on returning to Brazil to face charges. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is it. VOA's International Edition continues. The head of the U.S. Central Command has scolded Iran on Tuesday for provocative naval actions in the Persian Gulf. This is in response to recent close encounters between U.S. warships and Iranian gunboats. Here's General Joseph Votel.
Iran's actions here are in the Arabian Gulf are unlike anybody else. No one else does what they do in the Arabian Gulf. They don't go out and they don't drive fast boats towards military vessels out there in the same way that they do.
Well, the coastal patrol ship USS Squall was forced to fire warning shots to ward off an Iranian gunboat that was closing at high speed on another U.S. vessel nearby. The Pentagon said the Iranian gunboat ignored repeated U.S. warning flares and radio transmissions. Votel calls the actions alarming.
So what I call on Iran to do is to be the professional force that they claim to be. Professional militaries, professional maritime forces don't operate in that way. We acknowledge all parties, all countries in that area have the right to operate in international waters, but they should do so in a responsible manner.
Last week, U.S. officials said the Iranian craft came within 200 meters of the USS Tempest, raising the specter of military escalation. There was no immediate response from Iran to those comments. Hillary Clinton is wrapping a fundraising blitz in New York in the oceanfront destination known as the Hamptons. The Top Dollar Tour concluded on Tuesday night with performances from Jimmy Buffett and Jon Bon Jovi. This as the FBI is expected to release documents soon related to the investigation into her use of a private email server. The documents are being made public as the FBI responds to Freedom of Information Act requests. Clinton will head to Ohio later today, where she'll speak at the American Legion's annual convention. Meanwhile, Republican Donald Trump is facing a pivotal moment in his campaign. He's set to explain the immigration policies that have been at the center of his White House run. He will lay out the plan later today in Arizona, a southwestern state, along the U.S. southern border with Mexico. And for years, one of the focal points of U.S. efforts to curb the stream of illegal migrants into the country. But before Trump's speech, we have just learned that he will be meeting with Mexico's president. later in the day ahead of the speech. Now, joining me now is Greg Chen, Advocacy Director for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks for being with us, Greg. What do you think we can expect from Donald Trump's speech?
It's just not clear always exactly what his policy position is, or if he's making more general rhetorical statements. And that same problem applies now in what he might or might not say during his speech, namely that is he going to be clarifying his position or changing it on immigration or toning down the rhetoric but not really offering any new details of what his plan will be.
And there's also a lot of talk about whether or not he will be in favor of amnesty.
He has said so far, given some hint, that he's shifting his positions away from previous calls he's made for a mass deportation strategy towards some kind of possible legalization plan. And he said that, you know, deporting whole families would be tough. And he's expressed some interest in allowing what he defines as, or has said are good ones, good people, to be able to stay, and that bad ones presumably wouldn't be able to stay and would be deported. But he hasn't yet explained what any of that means. And what I would be looking for, and I think what the public should be listening for, is whether he is really talking about a plan that would provide for legalization of the undocumented and what the details of that plan is. One important thing is that real reform in this area, lasting reform to address the status of the undocumented, cannot be done without legislative reform. And Trump has made some suggestions that people who are non-citizens that are here, immigrants who are here, could simply follow the law and leave the country first before qualifying for legalization. Now, that might sound straightforward, but it doesn't even have any basis in or any understanding of the current law, which doesn't really even have enough green cards for people to leave the country and qualify for. And it's been more than 25 years since our laws were last updated in terms of how many green cards are available for family members to be able to come here, businesses or workers to be able to fill in the employment sector. So the law just is not adequate right now. And so Trump needs to indicate whether he is serious about addressing this problem. And one clear marker is whether or not he's actually talking about legislative reform. It's not something that he can just say, oh, we're just going to try to make some little quick fixes that he can do on his own as president and tell people to start following the law and leaving the country.
Initially, he said the 11 million people in the United States illegally have to go, and they will be going. Logistically speaking, how realistic would something like that be?
That is a widely discredited concept, that having this 11 million number of people leave the country, could even be done effectively with any kind of enforcement mechanism without being, you know, completely, first of all, destroying some of the foundations of American society and the economy. There are whole sectors of the American economy, such as the agricultural sector, other industries that depend upon undocumented labor. And part of the reason is that, as I said before, it's been more than 25 years that the employment categories of immigration just haven't been reformed, and we are operating under an antiquated system that isn't meeting the needs of our economy. So people have been coming and filling jobs that our economy needs, and yet at the same time, our laws say you shall not come.
Do we have a problem with illegal immigrants being criminals?
The issue I think you're raising is, you know, Donald Trump and other candidates and policymakers have indicated that certain people shouldn't be allowed to stay. And how do we make that determination? Trump has simply used terms like the good ones versus the bad ones, very broad. That doesn't give us any real sense of what he's talking about. An important indicia to look at is whether people who are here, who are undocumented, are contributing members of our communities, or whether or not they might actually present real threats to our public safety, to our communities. It's widely supported in polling of American people that over 70% of Americans think those who are here who are undocumented should have a way of being able to stay, especially when you recognize that so many of them have families here. And if we're trying to decide who should be able to stay and who shouldn't, there should be clear criteria for that to make the program successful, and making sure that people who pose threats to our communities, that they are not allowed to stay. I think that is a legitimate way to do it. Being careful about how that is done is going to be devil in the details.
What do we know about Hillary Clinton's ideas for immigration reform?
Hillary Clinton has been fairly clear that she intends to present a plan for immigration reform within her first 100 days. She said it would be a comprehensive plan. She says she supports the legalization of those who are undocumented, and that they should have a way to be able to stay here permanently in the United States. She's also made statements that people who are not threats to public safety and to our communities should be able to stay here in the United States. And so she's been more clear about her policy prescriptions. And I think the challenge for Donald Trump will be whether he can actually provide some more clear policy prescriptions that are understandable and that make sense within the current immigration system, because many of the things he's said so far sound more like rhetoric rather than actual workable policy.
All right. Greg Chen, Advocacy Director for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. We appreciate it. President Barack Obama preparing to depart later this week for an upcoming trip to Laos and China for the G20 summit. At Monday's daily White House briefing, Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes briefed reporters on some of the expectations of the president's meeting with his Chinese counterpart.
The president very much looks forward to his eighth meeting with President Xi Jinping. What I think you'll see, both as an outcome of the meeting and I think in the content of the meeting itself, is a very broad-ranging discussion between two leaders that are committed to advancing cooperation everywhere we can on a range of global issues, from global warming and climate change to counterterrorism, to furthering our non-proliferation goals, to taking steps to strengthen the global economy.
This weekend's summit will be one of the last high-profile trips in the last 5 months of Obama's term as president. He'll also attend a dinner hosted by Xi and highlight his administration's 7-year effort to expand U.S. influence in Asia. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The political party convention is a critical part of the American electoral process. VOA correspondents are there, reporting the latest developments.
Kane Faribault, VOA News, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Jim Malone, VOA News, at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Tune in to VOA's extensive, up-to-the-minute coverage of the U.S. presidential election.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, we are hearing about a blossoming new pop star with a powerful message for women about their looks. But first, some actors and directors from Africa are getting the chance to learn from their counterparts working in Hollywood. After a competitive selection process, creative professionals from Africa will get to spend 3 weeks in Los Angeles visiting movie studios and taking intensive classes. Not only will they sharpen their skills in entertainment, but they'll receive training to become entrepreneurs. It's all made possible through a partnership with the African Technology Foundation, Relativity Education, and the U.S. State Department. We have more now from Elizabeth Lee reporting from a film shoot in Los Angeles.
Scene 2, extreme take 2, marker.
Action.
Shooting a film in the heart of Hollywood was a dream that is now very real for some African entertainers.
I could scream.
It's surreal, it's amazing, it's exciting for me because I never thought I would be here.
You have missed the deadline.
These students, all working industry professionals from different African countries, are part of a program called Hollywood in Focus They participate in workshops and get hands-on experience to expand their knowledge base in film production. For Ejim Fortune Kazi, learning about filmmaking here is much more visual and hands-on than back home.
It's been very practical. You can see these things. You don't just hear about them. You see them, you know how they work and all that.
The workshops also train these students to think of themselves as entrepreneurs.
You know, it's not a model anymore where you're waiting for the phone to ring to get hired into a gig. I mean, we're shifting, that this space is shifting from a gig economy to an entrepreneurial space, and a space where companies can be born, innovations can happen, and content can be distributed from independent voices.
This shift is happening because of the internet and changing technology.
So what you're finding is there are a lot of self-driven content creators. It's a lot of user-generated content. And on the consumption side, with the advent or with the growth of mobile technologies across Africa, a lot of this content can now be consumed for much less than it ever was. So the democratization of the process through digital media has empowered a whole new generation of content creators.
Who are also entrepreneurs. And these students are learning to think of themselves not only as actors or directors, but as a brand.
I see myself as an entrepreneur. The only glitch to that was I had no idea exactly how to sell my brand, because along the way you kind of sell yourself short sometimes because of the opportunities or because of the lack of the jobs.
These students say what they've learned here will not only enrich their careers, but also elevate the African film industry on the global stage.
To kind of get that experience here and, you know, put that in my own country and in my own, you know, scope, basically, just so we can be up to speed with what's happening around the world and, you know, give ourselves opportunities to be able to tell our own stories the way we want to.
After they graduate from the program, organizers say these creative professionals have the ability to positively impact their country's economy and culture through all the different forms of media. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
All right, well, some pop tunes have a serious message. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition Sarah Williams to talk about a new single by a young woman from north of the United States that has a message about beauty and body image.
Today, we're going to shine the spotlight on a 20-year-old pop star who is on the rise. She's from Canada, and her name is Alicia Cara. And she came on the scene about a year ago with a song which she put out called Here, which was actually written because of a party. It's about a party that's going not too well. She's not happy, and what am I doing here? And so she was inspired by an actual experience. In fact, the music video featured some of her friends who attended the party with her. And then she made it big a year ago on the pop charts and then followed that with Wild Thing. She was on tour this past year for her debut album, Know It All, and now she's out with her third single, actually fourth. But that's not what we're going to feature today. Today we're featuring the third single because it carries a social message with it.
And what is that social message?
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked. The social message, well, first of all, it'll be pretty obvious when I tell you the song title. The song is called Scars to Your Beautiful. Now, there seems to be an ongoing movement now with a lot of different stars and celebrities who are in the spotlight to bring attention to the fact that we don't have to look beautiful to be beautiful. And it's body image, self-awareness, that seems to be the in thing now. In fact, Alicia Keys and Alicia Cara both went to the MTV Video Music Awards show Sunday without makeup. And it was their statement to say that women in particular are judged by how they look. And they want to say that you can be beautiful without getting all made up and fancy hair and makeup and accept people the way they are. Now, this particular song for Alicia Cara, Scars to Your Beautiful, features a bunch of people who've had different, shall we say, physical imperfections, scars, physical scars, and also some emotional scars, too. But it's just like a montage of different people's faces. And, it you know, everybody's kind of there as a statement to you can be beautiful with scars.
She just wants to be beautiful. She goes unnoticed. She knows no limits. She craves attention. She praises an image. She prays to be sculpted by the sculptor.
there are a number of pop stars from Canada these
days. Amazing. Justin Bieber and The Weeknd and Drake, and the list goes on. And you can add Alicia Cara to that list now. And in fact, in her own country, Canada, Ontario, Canada, she won the Juno Award this past year for Breakthrough Artist of the Year. The Juno Awards are equivalent to the Grammys for Canada. And so she's been nominated for all kinds of awards, has won quite a few. The Much Music Video Awards gave her Best New Canadian Artist. And she was just nominated on Sunday at the MTV Video Music Awards show for Best Pop Video for her previous single, Wild Things. She did perform the new single with Troye Sivan on the show. And she's only 20. And she's already getting started. She got discovered at 13 by posting videos on YouTube.
Wow.
Which seems to be the thing to do these days if you want to get discovered. So she did that. She's been writing songs since she was about 10. Very talented young lady. I had her on Border Crossings. A pleasure to talk to her. And she is going out on tour with Coldplay. So that's a big act to get a lot of exposure with as they continue their European tour.
Yeah, and varying age groups, I think, among the fans.
Exactly. And one thing that she did tell me when I interviewed her is that her brother, she's got a younger brother who likes to say, I'm Alicia's brother, and he signs autographs as her younger brother. So he's enjoying the fame probably a little more than she is right now.
All right. There's a hope that's waiting for you in the dark. You should know you're beautiful just the way you are. And you don't have to change a thing. The world could change its heart. No scars to your beauty.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com anytime. We appreciate your joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The terrorist group Boko Haram has exacted a heavy toll on the people of Nigeria. The group has killed more than 20,000 people, displaced more than 2 million, and plunged some 7 million Nigerians into hunger and desperate need. In the past 2 years, Boko Haram has used more than 100 women and girls to carry out attacks. Speaking in Nigeria, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "No one anywhere should have to live among this evil, but it isn't going to disappear on its own." In recent months, there has been progress on the battlefield against Boko Haram. Over the last 6 months, the Nigerian army has rescued thousands of civilian hostages, and hundreds of Boko Haram fighters have surrendered to the Nigerian army. But beating Boko Haram on the battlefield is only the beginning of what needs to be done, said Secretary Kerry. To effectively counter violent extremism, military action needs to be coupled with a commitment to values like good governance, education, security, and respect for human rights. The fight against corruption has to be a priority of the first order, said Secretary Kerry. There is nothing more demoralizing to citizens than the belief that the system is rigged against them. The most basic duty the government has is to meet the needs of its people and to be accountable. Governments must provide equal opportunity for all, giving women and girls an equal chance to compete in the classroom and in the workplace. Finally, the government needs to promote compassion and understanding for fellow citizens. Breaking the terrorist cycle of violence requires treating those who escape or defect from Boko Haram, and particularly those who are abducted against their will, with sensitivity as they try to return to their old communities. Welcoming these individuals, especially women and girls, back into society without the threat of violence or discrimination, and ensuring that the millions who have been displaced in Nigeria and throughout the region get the humanitarian and government support that they desperately need. This, said Secretary Kerry, is the way you invest in a future that is free from violence and provides the stability and peace that Nigerians so desperately want.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.